Make me furious.
Yeah, that's the first line of the podcast.
There, shouldn't it be a ceviche soak off and a queso cook off?
Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, the White Sox local for baseball prospectus. Joining you once again from Chicago, Illinois, the home of Sox Fest, is me, James Segan, the editor-in-chief of BP Southside, for now. My guests tonight are Nick Schaefer, or what's your title, deputy editor?
Yeah, for now.
In Manhattan, New York, I think, or did you switch to Kansas?
That's still New York for now.
Well, are you in Roxbury, though?
I'm in Roxbury, Connecticut for the evening, yes.
Not a real place.
Also joining us, we have Mark Primiano in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And Frank Furkey in, I forget, so now I just have to say New York City.
Brooklyn.
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 What's it like being the worst, Jennings? You already have forgotten where we all live.
Manhattan.
No, I moved out of there, you jerk.
I was talking about Nick.
Were you?
I was talking about the fact that Frank is from Brooklyn means he can kick Nick's ass.
Well, yeah. Nick only works out his glamour muscles.
Jane's from Brooklyn, too, so she'll second that for sure.
Also, James, you should know that, you know, people who went to private school and grew up in Kenwood can throw down the best of them.
Mm-hmm. That's how it works. We are here on the eve before the Rick Renteria ceviche cook-off. And I believe there's some technical questions that Mark wanted to raise about it.
Yes. Yes, there are.
Is it mostly about the fact that a paid underling of Renteria is the judge of the cook-off, Tyler Saladino?
No. The main issue is that you can't call it a ceviche cook-off. You can't call it a cook-off if it's not cooking. That'd be like calling it, like, look at this salad cook-off. It's not a salad cook-off. You don't cook salad. You don't cook ceviche. Call it like meat. A ceviche competition.
There's meat in the
would
ceviche.
Would you rather call it a... No, it should be a cure-off.
That would be bad, too. Just, like, come up with something else. It's not a cook-off.
It's a Kirilov.
It's like, hey, come eat this gross raw shit. That's not a cook-off.
No love for my Minnesota Twins prospects. Pun there? No?
No.
What did you say?
I'm loud and angry about raw fish.
I said call it a Kirilov.
You're trying too hard, Nick.
But I think you just don't know the minors as well as you probably should. Also... Prior to hitting record, Mark posited that Lyle Overbay is the best player of all time to play.
Nick cutting out means that Mark's reputation is saved.
I'm throwing.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear who the counterexample is.
I'm throwing Aaron Hill's name in that ring.
He played for shit. He did play for Milwaukee, didn't he?
The best Diamondback Brewer. Blue Jay of all time.
Damn you. Aaron Hill is the name of a tutor I got in undergrad for business calculus that I chose solely because his name was Aaron Hill, and that was the name of a baseball player. I got a C in business calculus.
How would you have done without Aaron Hill?
I would have gotten a D in business calculus.
The system worked.
That's basically what you get when you upgrade a position with Aaron Hill. This is the weekend of Sox Fest, and actually there was acquisition news. They signed Peter Borjo? How do you say his name?
I've always pronounced it like Borges because I think people called him Gorgeous Borges for a while.
Right.
Wow.
Peter Borges is really fast, but probably not that fast as he used to be, and has hit pretty terribly for 3 years now.
And is he going to get lost in an infinite library?
What's his reference?
Oh, Jorge Luis Borges.
Oh, that's good. That's a good reference.
That's the best work anyone's done with that.
Yeah, that was legitimately good. That was like, wow.
So he's 20 out of 35 stealing bases for the last 3 years. He can play center field, but he doesn't seem... I don't feel like he's going to steal playing time from Charlie Tillman.
He also had that sweet, sweet 17-91 walk-to-strikeout ratio last year that you love in your failed speedster center fielder.
I believe, Nick, you said like the most thing you knew about him was that Philly fans hated him, which is really weird for kind of a fill-in guy during a rebuilding year to evoke strong emotions.
I think that was Collins' point on him, but I think it's possible Philly fans hated him.
I wouldn't blame them. He played like shit last year.
What is that noise?
That's someone typing very weirdly.
I see.
I was looking at... I mean, you look at the outfield that they have, the fact that Borges might be able to, you know, adequately play defense might put him in the top three of what they have currently. So certainly one's mouth.
I would suggest, one, that if you're going to use the laptop mic, that typing looks like it will register really loudly.
I'm not typing.
Okay, I was attempting to do some live SQL queries, read the Blue Jays, Brewers, Diamondbacks questions, but I will stop.
Keep going.
I'm literally, my hands are under, are not anywhere close to the keyboard. So
the name of this podcast episode is now going to be Live SQL Theories Queries. I've had a gin.
Sox Fest gin?
Yes, actually. So something that came out of SoxFest, where I've been the last few days, is Han was pretty energetic about saying that in light of it being a rebuilding year, he would like to see an opportunity for Charlie Tilson to play everyday center field. So that was something he said like 6 hours after the Borgio signing, so it seemed pretty indicative of him trying to clarify his position.
You might as well let him. Like, what is there to lose this year to see if, hey, can this dude be more than a fourth outfielder? So, yeah, this year is going to be terrible. You might as well let him handle center. You're not going to go out and get something better.
Yeah, he's the only one with any semblance of upside at center field who's ready to play in the majors. Although, you know, I don't
find him as depressing as having another year of Avi in right field, where that's just like, yes, in theory, he might finally be worth a damn when we all know he won't. Tilson, it's like, hey, maybe you'll stumble into like a one or two WAR guy.
Right. I mean, he also hasn't driven us insane yet. He's played one game and he got a hit. So,
500 OBP.
I wish I knew. I can't really think of anybody else who straight up tore a hamstring the way he did. So I don't really know what the recovery profile's like for that injury.
He was walking around without wincing at SoxFest, which is a big step. Wearing jeans, walking on carpet.
But it's not like, you know, when like Jared Mitchell tore his Achilles, and I know from being a sports fan generally that torn Achilles can really just like permanently diminish what you can do as an athlete.
I thought it was an ankle tendon.
Human in general.
I mean, we do have a medical professional on this podcast.
Yes, we do. He's also very handsome.
It's you.
It is me. Frank, is your keyboard like from an old Compaq computer?
No, but it is a junky laptop. I do have a list of position players, though I haven't gotten their names. I just have their IDs. So I'll go back to mute and keep sequeling.
Now I don't know if the episode should be live sequel queries or keep sequeling.
Or I can, you know, talk about Charlie Tilson, but...
I only view Tilson with a slightly more enthusiastic bent than, say, Jacob May and Adam Engel. To some degree, I would wonder, like, why add center field depth when you have, like, three of those guys to just kind of throw against the wall, but then I find myself wondering why I'm fretting about a minor league deal for some guy who's probably going to wow the Knights fans for most of the year.
Well, Tilson, it was my understanding that Tilson was sort of ahead of where Engel and May were, but maybe I'm overstating that. I mean, I think he had like a hit for higher average and struck out less in the high minors.
Definitely, but they're all at AAA.
Yeah, and he has the benefit of coming from an organization that has produced people that can hit.
He did also like OPS like 750 in the PCL. So.
Yeah, and Mark, I was thinking about that, and that kind of cuts both ways. On the one hand, yes, it's like, hey, this wasn't a White Sox draft pick, so maybe he could hit. But also, if the Cardinals let him go, I don't know.
Yeah, but how many grindy white guys can they legitimately have on their roster at a time? 20, and they've reached that capacity.
Right, they have to have the guys they get out of their Latin program. We throw like 105 for the rest of those spots. So yeah, makes sense. Ooh, those are some names in the Slack there, courtesy of
Frank. That's looking like Aaron Hill and then Lyle Overbay.
That's really dismissive of Royce Clayton.
You're not taking Royce Clayton?
Devon White is in here.
Yeah, the best actual player in there is Devon White, but I mean, I didn't know he was always hurt, right?
So, you know, I'm pretty proud of myself for being able to pull Lyle Overbay as, like, my idea of number one without looking anything up.
Royce Clayton, Rock and Jock baseball appearances, 1. The rest of the field, 0.
Royce Clayton, major motion productions, 1. The rest of the field, 0.
What was he in?
He was in Moneyball. He played Miguel Tejada.
Yeah. Did a good job, too.
That's bizarre.
It's incredibly bizarre, but it's true.
Has he gotten any follow-up roles in like
the probably not
about like the 08 Orioles or something?
Frank, can you sequel that question?
But other movie roles from Royce Clayton?
Yep, that's the only way to find it.
I'm really not sure why.
So, yeah, someone hit IMDb.
He doesn't even look like Miguel Tejada. It's very strange.
He has a lot of appearances as himself.
Well, yeah, that's kind of how it works.
He was a bomb squad officer in one episode of Martial Law in 1999.
The hell is that?
Please tell me that's a TV show about the character from Tekken.
It might be. It says a Shanghai cop who is a master of martial arts fights crime in the LA Police Department. It starred Sammo Kambo Hung and Arsenio Hall.
I would watch the hell out of that.
There are 44 episodes.
In a TV series called Dad's Doing Dishes.
The poster says Kick in the Pants Television.
He appeared on Sunday Night Baseball quite a few times, playing himself.
I did not know there was an actress. Apparently, there was an actress on Martial Law named Tammy Lauren, who has probably been very upset the last 6 months.
It's been rough. Brand in most circles.
The Tekken character is named Martial Law, like the normal first name Marshall, which is why I got very excited. It's much less exciting that this Royce Clayton TV show is just normal Martial Law.
The character's name is Sammo Law.
Why have we not watched this, James?
Also, Arsenio is the second leading actor.
It is an American-Canadian action crime drama that aired on CBS from 1998 to 2000. What? This was on for 3 years?
44 Jackie Chan episodes.
Had a cameo as a background extra.
How did none
that's
of us know about
this? That's a really good use of Jackie Chan.
It was Sammo
Like, if
Campbell
you're
going
to get him to come to set and you
oh
can't
my God.
Get him to actually appear.
You guys need to go to the Wikipedia page right now and look at the series poster for it.
Is it the if you can read this, you're too close?
Yeah. Kick in the Pants Television.
It aired on Saturdays.
Yeah.
They still show TV on Saturdays, do they? Like it's all reality.
Asian man doing a terrible karate kick. And I want to watch every episode of this show.
They've apparently had bloopers play before each episode's closing credits. That's classy stuff.
Okay, so that's like Jackie Chan as hell.
He made crossover appearances on Walker, Texas Ranger.
Bloopers were a really valuable currency in the 90s, right? Like, people cared about bloopers.
The show was.
I think it's just that people like Jackie Chan, and he can do bloopers, and nobody else can.
The show was a surprise hit, making Hung the only East Asian headlining a primetime network series in the U.S. At the time, he was not fluent in English and worried about the audience's ability to understand him. In many scenes, he did not speak at all, making Martial Law perhaps the only U.S. television series in history that featured so little dialogue from the lead character. That has two citations.
Famous That's quotes.
It was released on VCD.
What is that?
It was back when they used to put videos on CDs. The only thing I've ever watched on it is bootleg Kung Fu movies when I was 12.
So basically this.
Also, the Wikipedia article misspells some of the episode titles.
I'm going to read the famous quote from the show.
This sounds
Does it have a Wiki quote?
I'm on IMDb still.
This sounds like, you know, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., but worse, and I really need to watch this now.
Terrell has accidentally run over Otto the Rat with his car. Sammo.
Remember when we used to talk about baseball?
You know, in China, some people believe the death of a rat means 7 years of bad luck. Terrell, you mean if I tell the kids about Otto, the curse will go away? Sammo, no, you are doomed.
That's good dialogue.
I feel like if I were an undercover cop, I wouldn't make jokes about killing rats.
That's like David Simon quality dialogue.
He was heavily inspired, I'm sure, to,
yeah,
you know, McNulty's just a takeoff on Sammo Law.
James, was martial law declared at SoxFest?
At one point in the media room, yes.
Go on.
I don't know. There was nothing actually interesting in the media room other than it was cold.
And so people brought someone a Cuban sandwich.
John Greenberg has a really puffy winter coat and he put it on.
You mentioned that there was some talk about Giolito's mechanics.
Oh, yes, there was. Lucas Giolito, a fine, upstanding gentleman who was
a terror in the kitchen.
A bit. He seemed like a very thoughtful dude. He's pretty, you know, self-effacing about his debut in Washington. And he said, like, I was awful. I learned a lot from it and all that. He definitely was a bit more, I'd like talk to him. I asked him, you know, switching from Washington, they had you doing a lot of tinkering. Does all that kind of get thrown out now that you're with Chicago and you're working with someone else? And he kind of is like, oh, no, it's a more simple approach. We're talking about what we want to do. It's like, he made it seem like it was much more like, what are you working on? And we'll figure out how to, like, build you towards where you want to be. And he praised Cooper a lot. Han was more blunt, kind of because someone confronted him on a panel and said, like, you know, I heard that Giolito has, like, a hitch in his delivery that's going to make his shoulder pop at some point. And he was just like, he had issues last year with Washington because they changed some mechanics, and that's what reduced his velocity a bit. And we're going to try to get him back to the mechanics he had as an amateur. Which, you know, is kind of something, because Lucas Giolito was drafted 2, 3, 4 years ago at this point, tossing out, like, all that mechanics work implies that they had pretty big issues with what they saw.
I mean, Keith Law had Giolito still up near the top of the top 100. I mean, I don't want to go, I hesitate, I don't want to tip too much of his behind paywall content, but it did seem to me that the impression I got was he wasn't troubled by Giolito's struggles in the majors last year, and he attributed it to the mechanics tinkering, and he seemed to think it was something he could get past. So Flaw thinks that, and clearly the White Sox think that if they acquired him. I'm willing to defer to the judgment of both of those entities on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think if your fear was not knowing if the White Sox are just buying a depressed asset, or if the White Sox saw specifically something that they thought they could fix that would bring him back to his, you know, ace potential status, the messaging this weekend was definitely the latter.
Yeah, and I think a quote that was it from Hostetler who said that he had Collins 1-1 on his draft board?
Yes. Hostetler was very bold today. He said that Collins would have been his pick if he had the first selection. And he also said, like, he selected Birdie with the 26th pick. He said if he had the 27th pick, the 27th pick would have been Hanson.
Whoa. I guess I don't really have anything to... So with taking those one at a time, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but this draft didn't have as clear-cut a number, you know, number one or number two guys as some have in the past. You know, there wasn't a superstar clear-cut 1-1 here, and I think it was in flux, like, all the way up to the end. I think Senzel to the Reds was one of, like, the few things that people seemed pretty confident about. But, I mean, A.J. Puck was, I thought, the name associated with the number one pick the most for a long time, and then he slid to, was, like, 5 or 6, and then he has not, apparently, he's kind of backed up since then as well. And I'm trying to think of who, like, Jason Grom was somebody that people really liked at 1-1, but he had makeup questions and signability questions. He went at 12. So Collins being one of the safest bats in the draft, I mean, if you think he can catch, then, I mean, like, when I say if you think he can catch, I'm saying, like, literally, if you take that as a given, then, yeah, he would have been one of the two or three best players in the draft.
Yeah, so, like, if outside the White Sox, no one thinks Collins can catch. No one faults the White Sox for trying to get him to catch, especially, like, you know, his first full year in the organization. Why would they abandon that? But confidence is under 10% as far as that, to the point where even if he had, like, you know, more of a fringe chance of being a catcher, he's someone that probably goes in the top five. So the White Sox public messaging is very intent. Rick Hahn was asked point blank, like, you have basically nothing as far as catcher depth. You're going to run out Narváez as your number one catcher, and he's, you know, very unproven, and you have really, like, no prospects after that. One thing he amusingly said was he cited, like, Alfredo Gonzalez as being, like, a really good framer, which was eye-opening to hear Hahn say after last year. But the other thing is, like, we have Zach Collins. He thinks that Zach Collins is the future of the franchise at catcher. And for a team that really doesn't have anybody who is, like, projects to be even starter at catcher, it's one thing to say, like, we think you can be a catcher, but you're still, like, you know, loading up the position. It's another thing for that's your end-all, be-all answer at this point. And obviously they probably will load up a catcher a bit more down the road, but they're very steadfast on that. So if their belief is really 100% that Collins can catch and they're sticking to it, which is, you know, still a longer shot than, say, Tim Anderson was at short, but, you know, it kind of brings up memories of them being kind of singularly focused on that while others were doubting them. Then yeah, he would be a 1-1 guy if you thought he was, like, a 85-90% chance to catch. Then yeah, he could be, you know, the best hitting catcher in baseball or one of the five best in 5 years from now. So yeah, that'd be significant.
Yeah, I mean, they do have recent, I mean, I guess it's not super recent now, but, you know, Tyler Flowers, when they got him, was a guy where it was kind of like Collins. There was, like, well, the bat'll play anywhere, but there's no way this dude's a catcher. And then, you know, fast forward to present day where it's like, man, Tyler Flowers sure can catch, too bad about his bat. So, like, these things can change, and catcher prospects are, I think, you know, about as fickle as you can get on the position player side. So, you know, it's not, there's, like, a lot of uncertainty there, but that can, you know, that can be good uncertainty too when you have a guy, when the consensus seems to be he can't catch.
Are we concerned about the lack of catching depth given the number of good arms they're going to try to develop in the next year and a half or whatever in the bigs? That's one of the things that just strikes me is, like, if they don't have a competent receiver, that potentially, in the way that Rodon had some issues, could add up for things down the line.
I mean, one thing that Hahn said about Narváez is that he thinks he has a good rapport with Rodon, which probably is what, I don't know, gave them confidence to stick with him as pretty much the primary starter going in. The numbers don't really bear that out as Narvaez being like in a, you know, really exceptional anything receiving wise, either throwing out bases or even framing. But I guess they think that relationship isn't bad. The fact that he cited like Alfredo Gonzalez as like the 12th best professional framer according to Baseball Prospectus. I would like to talk to him about Baseball Prospectus catcher framing stats with, you know, the 2016 roster a bit more.
I mean, you also, Narvaez isn't, you know, he's not Buster Posey where he's going to like elevate your pitchers, but I don't think he's, at least from watching him, he didn't seem to be so bad that he'd be like an actively harmful back there either. To me, Narvaez, the question is just like, is he going to slug like 230 or something and maybe be unplayable? But as far as concerned about pitchers, you know, and the other thing too is like, and granted, this skill set's getting valued more as framing becomes more of a thing, but, you know, Rene, what is it? Rene Rivera, I think, for the Mets, and like Martin Maldonado, all these alliterative catchers are out there who, you know, you can grab a glove only catcher, I think. I mean, when Jason Castro was out there, I'm blanking on who it was. Somebody comped it, was saying like, how much better is he really than like Hank Conger, I think, was like another
still training.
Yeah. Who's like another, you know, if you're really worried about your pitchers, especially in a rebuilding, from a rebuilding perspective, you could go out there and just grab a dude who all he can do is catch and he can't hit like at all.
So, yeah. I understand that they can do that. I'm just a little worried looking at the catching depth chart and not seeing anybody that you really want catching 110 games.
And when you're, and I think it's pertinent too, when you're accumulating all these guys who have like crazy dynamic stuff and not the best command.
Yeah, you got definitely like a bunch of guys, I wouldn't say Rodon clones, but could face similar issues.
But I think Navarro was a pretty extreme negative.
Yeah.
As far as that goes.
He was definitely a guy who, as much as I would discourage in general, you could probably TV scout his framing a little bit.
Yeah, where he took those pitches like right down the middle, like a foot out of the zone.
And just kind of like, yeah, lazily snatched it.
Were there any other highlights to you from Sox Fest at all, or
there were plenty. Han said he doesn't want anybody he traded for to start in the majors. Like, he was very steadfast about it, and which he kind great. Of acknowledged that previously guys would get rushed because of need, and he wants it to be clear that the situation the roster is in, that should never happen again. That they should be very conservative about promoting people, like only after it's like the last stage of development has like been completed in AAA does he want anyone promoted. Now, there are financial reasons for that, but there's also, I think, a real trying to like drive the franchise away from its reputation of being rushing guys.
I think it'll be kind of ironically, there's also, it can be harder to hold guys back because your major league roster isn't as strong. I guess that's sort of the, I don't know, call it a paradox, but one of the ironies of rebuilding, where like Ronaldo Lopez probably needs some more time in AAA, and he could certainly use some time getting acclimating himself to the White Sox pitching philosophy and what have you, before he gets called up. But like, even Ronaldo Lopez not ready is probably one of the five best starters, and like even more so if Quintana gets traded. So I guess it's just one of those things where you gotta just make sure you stick to your principles and make sure you're keeping your long-term strategy in mind. I mean, as you know, from the fan angle, you're like, oh great, you know, if the team can get extra years of control, that's good for their payroll, and that frees up money to sign other players, and that makes the team better. But then at the same time, it's hard for me to like root against like somebody who deserves to be up in the majors and
probably, you know, deserves to be making that money. So either way, it's just something they're going
to. It's a lot easier to like proclaim this now than when June and James Shields looks exactly the same. And
Derek's on the DL.
Derek Collins on the DL, and Ronaldo Lopez and Lucas Giolito, and say Brett Laurie's on the DL, or you've traded him to somebody. And Yan Mankata are all murdering AAA, and they're all guys who have played in the majors already. And what's your reason for holding any of these people back? Now, if I'm throwing out June, so obviously you're probably not calling it a rush job that these guys make up at June, but the general idea would be these are all guys who have reached the majors already. Really, we just kind of like want them to start in AAA to kind of provide confirmation that they've conquered that level and are ready. But they could definitely kind of be overwhelming if they're healthy and right and their mechanics are in the right place pretty early. So
was there any discussion about having any of the guys that they think of as starters working in the bullpen for a little while when they come up? I mean, they did that with Rodon. They did that with Sale.
It's also a very traditional way of breaking pitchers into the majors. As Johan Santana did that as well.
It definitely wasn't mentioned either way. Kind of, it wasn't ruled out or something they suggested they would do.
It also makes a lot less sense if you aren't trying to be competitive, because you're not trying to like get a small amount of good innings when you already have some good starters. And you are, to the extent that they want to play service time games, you're burning service time in a way that's less developmental long term.
Right. I wouldn't rule it out. They have so many guys that they're trying to convince themselves or prove are starters. So I feel like they might be hesitant to kind of get them locked in that role, but I also think they're not going to necessarily be overflowing with slots for all of like Carson Fulmer, Lucas Giolito, and Reynaldo Lopez to all just like start taking starts in the middle of the year. Like they can trade, like if Shields is bust and they trade Miguel Gonzalez and Holland, who knows what's happening with him? I suppose but there is a lot of room. They have a lot of guys thrown there.
Yeah, I mean, do we think there's any? I've sort of been a little perplexed. Well, perplexed is strong, but I've been a little surprised they haven't gone out and picked up a couple more sort of stopgaps for this year, lottery tickets, like guys, veterans hoping for bounce back. Just because if Quintana's supposed to be gone and Gonzalez looks like we're trading and Holland is made of glass, there's just a lot of, and Shields is maybe done. There's a lot of innings.
Yeah,
with nobody to throw them except for Don.
I expected Quintana to be moved by now, and now it seems like they're a lot less optimistic about that happening, at least before the season. Shields was only really addressed in terms of like being a mistake. Someone just asked Han, like, what were you thinking? And he didn't really try to like defend it at all. He just said that it was kind of a mistake born out of desperation. And he talked about DFA and Danks because he thought he's done, and that he thought Latos's days are limited, and how he's just burning through guys, and just how the situation where they're trying to patch holes in real time made him reach out for a stopgap, which was what he called Shields. And that what he's trying to do now is to, build the sort of depth where he's not in that position anymore. He didn't really make any defense of it or try to rationalize it. Now, that could just be him reading a room, which is like no defense of James Shields is going to go over well with the Sox Fest crowd. But he really just said, like, well, he kind of tried to use it for his arguments. Like, I don't want to ever have to be in that position again. And Cooper speaking with Garfine's podcast like last month, even that he was trying to say like, oh, a clean slate will do him good, but he prefaced it by saying like, well, no one's stuff is really going to be as good, you know, 10 years into their career. So I'm not seeing like a ton of organic optimism other than beyond optimism's sake for Shields.
Right. I mean, because you're definitely stuck with him. And I guess it was, jarring just, maybe it's because he was suddenly so ineffective that you just, there's still that part of your brain that's like, well, maybe this is an outlier because this is so, such as like stark deviation so quickly. But actually speaking of both Chuck Garfine and Rick Hahn, there's a new thing popping up on here saying Hahn said some scouts see Moncada eventually moving to center field. So that kind of oddly touches on a bunch of topics we just hit.
Yeah, Garfine kind of modified that a bit. Not that the White Sox are looking to move into center field or think he has to, but more just Hahn was acknowledging that some people have said his athleticism is such that if they needed to or wanted to, he could play center field. I think he was trying to bring it up in a way to laud Moncada's credentials more than he was trying to state it as specific direction that they would pursue.
Right. Just sort of like, well, you know, he's fast enough or whatever, he could do it. But
like kind of like a weird Bill Brasky story about Yan Moncada.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of where these guys' stock currently is, I mean, BP hasn't released their 101 yet, right?
No, but Moncada is not going to be the number one overall.
No, I know that. I mean,
he's going to be higher than Law put him.
Moncada was third in the White Sox system.
Yeah,
under Law.
Yeah.
But Law is probably like the high man in all of the world on Kopech.
Yes. Part of that's, part of me saying that, you know, he's third in the system, part of that's that he's still really high on Kopech. And, I mean, he's the highest on Kopech probably.
He has Kopech like global top five, right?
He has him seven, but the highest pitching prospect.
Okay.
He has him ahead of Alex Reyes, which I think is not typical. Obviously, I mean, they're, you know, when you're talking about top 10 or 15 or whatever it is, like a point, you know, a slot or two here or there is really not that significant. And he had some very specific questions about Reyes' delivery, which I thought were interesting. He was certainly lower on Moncada than other outlets. MLB Pipeline still has him, what, two or something like that. You know, we know that he's not going to be number one on BP either.
I can say that Moncada said that he saw Bo Jackson walking around and said he nearly passed out. Or Kopech, sorry, Kopech said that.
Oh, I was going to say that, and we can get all sorts of like Bo Yo knows.
I was also going to say like, wow, how does Moncada know that much about Bo Jackson? He's only living in our country for like no time.
Yeah, you know, the typical associating Kopech and Moncada together look alike very much.
Potato, potato.
Kopech was rocking a man bun at
Moncada, Moncada.
Friday media session. And he also said he has the potential to be better than Syndergaard.
I mean, if you wanted to, I mean,
he said it very diplomatically, but it's still funny.
Potential is, I mean, that right? That just means that his, you know, 99.9th percentile outcome is better than Syndergaard. That's probably true.
He said, without trying to talk down on Noah, because I have a lot of respect for Noah, I was with him last week. It's not up to me to live up to expectations. I'd like to think that my ceiling isn't another player's ceiling. So maybe one day I'm a better pitcher than him, and maybe one day he's a better pitcher than me. But I try not to compare myself to people too often.
Well, Syndergaard has had some elbow red flags, so, I mean, that is something to monitor moving forward. But
I don't think that was Kopech's point.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so either. That's the only analysis I'm going to throw in there. That's because I don't think Kopech has had any health problems other than breaking his hand punching someone in the face, right?
Right.
Was it in the face?
Well, I don't know, but punching someone. But these lists just kind of go to show how much of a difference you can get between different evaluators. And, you know, these public lists are people – it's impossible really to get eyes on all these guys in terms of, you know, recent performance. And so it's a lot of secondhand information and experience and applying that to the information you have and drawing different conclusions. Like Ronaldo Lopez is top 50 or something like that for MLB because they think he could be a starter, and Keith Law doesn't have him on his top 100 at all because he just doesn't think he can be a starter. And I think that having him off of one top 100 and in the middle of another kind of tells us the same thing as if he'd been like 75 on both in a way, because it's just describing the variance of his possible outcomes.
Something that was interesting to me was how kind of insular the kind of American top player circuit can be in terms of like showcases and like, you know, the small cluster of top college programs. Was that like Giolito, Birdie, Fulmer, Danish all knew each other. They'd all seen each other at some level of showcase or specifically had their teams play each other in the College World Series. They were all like familiar with one another. Whereas like Lopez, who would theoretically be in the middle of this glut of like prospects, was like, you know, first of all, he wasn't there, and like barely anyone had had any kind of encounter for them. Like, if you just kind of collect, you know, five white American top of the 20 white American arms, you'll probably find five guys who have each other's cell phone number. But if you mix in a couple like the Latin American players, like they can only speak on their reputation. It was a really weird connection.
Well, it is crazy to I mean, it's something that and it kind of ties into something I touched on in my Minoso piece that I wrote a few days ago, where, you know, teams weren't required to have Spanish language translators until last year by the league. I'm sure most of them already did anyway, but that there is this sort of that clubhouses can be clicky and it can fall down on language barriers, which, you know, I mean, it makes sense. It's path of least resistance in a lot of ways. And apparently that's something that Cespedes was really good at. I remember reading that he was really good at breaking through that particular barrier in the clubhouse. So, so being able to observe that firsthand, I mean, it's something that's really easy to forget about when you're just watching on TV. So that must have been you got to observe that in real time.
Yeah,
they said that about Uribe too.
Anderson kind of breaks that a bit. I mean, he seemed pretty charismatic and like he rolled in all the circles. But he also, even being from this country, had, you know, a very different background and path to the major leagues than them. He wasn't at an elite program. He wasn't really, you know, someone who was focused on as a prep prospect either. He actually had my favorite slyly super cocky line of the weekend. I kind of asked him about his defense and things that like he progressed well with in his rookie season. He just like, yeah, I impressed myself.
It's a good line.
Yeah, it was super cocky, but now I like him.
Well, he seemed to have, from what I could tell, he seemed to have sort of stolen the show in some respects, that he's just sort of charismatic in a way that sort of jumps out.
He was really easygoing. He was, you know, any question about, like, are you worried about playing a rebuild? Are you worried about losing? He was very much, like, nonchalant. Like, no, we're going to have fun. It's going to be no big deal. We got a lot of young guys. We're talented. We'll be better than you think. He seemed very confident. He seemed very cool with everything going on. I asked him about, like, you know, some people say, like, you don't walk enough. I was kind of, like, trying to, like, you know, premise that and then still say he hit for average. But he's like, I don't listen to that. I'm just going to do what I do. he didn't have any problems.
It makes sense, right? He's had what could have been a very challenging path, and he's made it fairly smooth. certainly compared to most of the other guys in the organization. So not that surprising that he would be not too worried about things.
Well, yeah, wasn't he? He was also supposed to be ultra raw, and you can see in what ways that he kind, you know,
he acknowledged that
real quick, but like he still moved faster and was more productive than most people in his draft class. So I guess that's what happens when you get freak athletes like that, or can't happen, I should say.
He managed to like give kind of like, well, I haven't even been playing baseball very long, as like kind of an excuse, but made it sound confident. He's an impressive young man.
You get a load of what happens when I've actually played for a little bit.
Yeah, he's like, you know, I don't even worry about that. I haven't even been playing that long. So I'm just doing what I'm doing. I was like, is Steverson making you work on anything specific? It's like, no, there's nothing really like I need to do. Like, I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing.
I hope that's not like famous last words, but
yeah, that is the sort of thing where you hear about that. And then you compare that to all the stories about the guys who have very structured approaches to this thing. But
so speaking Mike of that, Abasail.
Are we going to get a best shape of his life out of him, you think?
He wasn't there, which he's definitely been there in the past, so I thought that was interesting. When asked about the designated hitter slot, Renteria talked about it as a swing role. He did not mention Matt Davidson. He did not mention Abasail Garcia. He only mentioned Frazier, Abreu, and Melky Cabrera. He did get it when they were asked directly about Abasail. Rick Renteria talked about him being, you know, he said he still has potential, and if he didn't have potential, he wouldn't be there. He said that he is a guy with a lot of natural pop. He doesn't need to like sell out for power. I would say at this point in his career, he might as well sell out for power, so he could just like, say, be good at one thing.
It's a very weird way to phrase what Abasail Garcia is good at.
I mean, I would say if like there's what would I announce as like Abasail Garcia's appeal, it would be like he has untapped raw power, because I wouldn't boast that he's fast anymore, and I wouldn't like, I would say throwing arm, but like, I don't know, I feel like every poor defending corner outfielder who's too slow has a huge throwing arm that they can never use. So
comes with the bolt.
Like, how do you even distinguish? Like, Willie Gar, if you're just going to use the, you know, corner outfield prospects who have stalled and have raw power and throwing arms that they can never get to the ball on time to use, I would probably go with Willie Garcia because he has a bigger throwing arm.
I mean, there are instances. I've heard about how, you know, like Trevor Plouffe and Dozier of Minnesota were actually originally both shortstop prospects who were trying to sort of hit the ball to all fields. And a particular Minnesota hitting coach, I'm blanking on who it was like, look, this isn't working for you. How about you sell out for pull power? And clearly Plouffe got like a few solid years, you know, as like an okay third baseman out of it. And Dozier is like a down ballot MVP candidate. If you have the raw, I mean, I'd have to think at this point with Abasail, you know, trying to refine what he's already doing seems kind of futile. And you might as well say like, hey, look, here's your strength. Let's just go for it, man. Stop trying to be a complete hitter and just do it and see what happens.
Yeah, I would think. I didn't get to hear from Steverson during the weekend. Renteria, I think, was he sounded like he wanted everybody to be capable. He wants like his cleanup hitter to be able to bunt and stuff like that.
That brings back extremely unpleasant memories.
He qualified it like a lot, like he wasn't going to force it, and he wasn't going to force small ball, and he said, people who pound the baseball, I'm going to let them pound the baseball. But I think Renteria was very much trying to appeal to the old school people in the room and convince them. He threw a lot of red meat out there. And I think he worked the room that he was in fantastically well. But I would imagine that having been with the Cubs organization and coming in now, kind of as someone directly brought in by Han, that he's probably pretty on board with advanced analytics. He definitely played like lip service to it and said, like, you know, he would do like a big display. He's like, I'm going to go with my gut and like get applause in the crowd and then kind of like shrink back into his chair and also listen to whatever numbers we have in any situation. Like,
Frank,
did he say anything about the, I guess, sort of expecting that all the veterans were going to be gone and now they're not? And it seems like trying to balance getting these various guys that they're trying to take flyers on chances while also recognizing that he has actual major league players he needs to play before they go away. I don't know. It seems like a point of concern where there's been managers in the past where they take over rebuilds and then they want to play the veterans in a way that's not helpful. Did anyone ask about that? Or
yeah,
something
he got
similar?
Asked, like, it was weird. Do you have experience from doing it with the Cubs? He tried to downplay it. He said, I just prepare everyone to execute on that day the best we can. And he said, like, you know, one thing I do focus on with this team is that when they're, you know, a younger team like this, you try to put them in more situations where they can develop and learn and try to stick with them through it a bit more. But he tried to make it seem like, you know, he's not going to, like, stand in front of, like, the clubhouse before a game and say, like, you know, the score doesn't matter. Everything is just, you know, a meaningless step for its, you know, development for hitting, and who cares? I'm going to, you know, just do a bullpen game today no matter what the score is and shit like that.
Eat at Arby's.
Yeah.
I'd hope that also, you know, coming in this situation where I'd hope that he wouldn't be making bad short-term, you know, short-term decisions at the expense of the long-term, because, you know, you think up, you know, the front office wouldn't be blaming him for not white knuckling out wins with like rookies and stuff like that. You know, like everybody knows the situation. The idea that Rendry would be forced to try to do stupid things to try to get a couple extra wins to like protect his job seems like if that were the case, then something's gone horribly wrong in the communication and the expectations.
Wasn't that an issue with Bo Porter in Houston? I mean, I know that Han is not Luno and Bo Porter is not Rick Renteria, but I thought that was one of the things that led to him getting the axe sort of earlier than they anticipated.
It was definitely also something that was mentioned with Renteria, the Cubs, at least early on during the season he was there. I think on one hand, you could say, like, oh, he has a history of doing this. On the other hand, you could say, if there's anybody who could be more clear about, who could have been more clearly told what he needs to do during a rebuild, he needs to be less on the gas, both with the Cubs and coming to the White Sox and over this past offseason with Han communicating with him about what they want, it would be him.
But I
definitely didn't feel like they were clashing in any way.
I mean, Renteria was only let go by the Cubs because Madden became available, right? Like, unexpectedly.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't have gotten rid of him on his own merits unless Madden was available, but there were definitely things that they were not, like, if they were 100%, if they thought Renteria was, like, secretly their new manager of the year that they had just discovered, they also wouldn't have ditched him for Madden.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a big gap between a good major league manager and perception of Joe Biden.
Joe Biden?
Yeah, Joe Biden. There is a pretty big gap there, but I meant Madden.
Madden's basically baseball Joe Biden.
he takes the train home to wherever every night.
I don't know if I want
to the wine bar.
Better that than driving.
Yeah, it's very safe. The way
unlike
I saw
other managers
was Han is presenting this very like studious, disciplined, kind of zero fun view of like you gotta invest in the long term and you know it'll pay off in the end and your equity will only grow, like lame boardroom presentation. And so Renteria was supposed to be the compliment to him and say like we're gonna play small ball and bunt and run really hard and to try to rev up the fan base that would otherwise kind of be bummed out by all this.
Is Kenny at Sox Fest?
He was. I mean, he was at the session that his wife was moderating, and then he left, and he didn't make any comments, but he's alive and well. He was at the, his wife moderated the session where kids asked Todd Frazier, Carlos Rodon, and Lucas Giolito questions. This is by far the best panel of the entire weekend. There's absolutely no rivals.
I think you alluded earlier to a favorite movie question. What were the answers?
For favorite movie? All right. I told you that Frazier's favorite movie was about prison rape. Frazier said that whenever Shawshank Redemption comes on, he just has to watch it.
Yeah. I figured the answer was Shawshank and not, like, the 13th or something like that.
Giolito said he loved Saving Private Ryan, which is another great movie to pitch the kids.
kids love Operation Overlord.
And Rodon liked Happy Gilmore. But
how old was Rodon when Happy Gilmore came out?
Yeah, that was my reaction. Thing.
Like, Rodon's super young. Rodon said growing up, he loved the Marlins. Like, I remember when the Marlins were created. And it's like, what's your favorite childhood memory? And he talked.
I was about, like, four.
He talked about Rodon. The Miguel Cabrera World Series team. Not even the first World Series team.
I'm looking up when Happy Gilmore came out because Rodon was like three when that came out.
Yeah.
It was on TV a lot. That was a fair point, Jane.
I do remember renting that when I was like 7 or 8, so when it was out on home video, but definitely did not stick with me as my favorite movie.
That's why you're not a professional athlete.
The only reason.
Yeah. Oh, is it Dontrell Willis who watched Troy before every start?
That would be really terrible.
I don't know
which would make me happier if that were genuinely true or if Frank just like made that up. I don't know which would be funnier.
Yeah, I found a Sports Illustrated article from May 30th, 2005 called Achilles Tendency. Subhead is Dontrell Willis is hooked on Troy. He saw it 4 times in the movie theater. He watches bits of Brad Pitt portraying Achilles on a DVD player before every start. I like the action, the spears flying through the air. It calms me down.
Can you imagine Dontrell Willis pitching if he weren't calm?
Yes.
As right-hander A.J. Burnett, with what Dontrell's doing now, he should probably watch that movie the rest of his career.
I hope that wasn't
like, imagination is tremendous.
I hope that wasn't like really bitter when he said it.
I thought AJ Burnett solely trucked in very bitter.
Yeah, I think so. In terms of, I was kind of amused to see that Carson Palmer still made like top 75 for MLB because I know Jim Callis has like loved him for forever. And, you know, obviously he's not that far removed from being a top 10 draft pick. And it's not like, you know, I'm not saying Callis is a crazy person, but he's definitely on the like high end of optimism for Fulmer at this point, I think. I don't know how much of that is too, is the phenomenon of like the new shiny things where, you know, Fulmer had a bit of a down year in terms of production in 2016. And then the White Sox just added like, you know, Hanson and Birdie in the draft and then added Giolito, Kopech and Lopez. And now all of a sudden Fulmer's like arguably what, like the seventh or eighth pitching prospect, like depending on how you look at it in the system. But not too long ago there's still people who have him in their top 100. So they could be when we talk about the rotation, not necessarily having a lot of options, they might be expecting Fulmer to be stepping in at that time when all those brittle guys are hitting the DL.
Fulmer said he felt really good at the end of last year with AAA.
I think the stats, I think his results were better then. I don't know about...
He was only
about
a handful of starts, but he definitely had good ones. But he name-checked Richard Dotson, who
we should probably think about more in terms of talking about, like, the reason for the White Sox pitching development being really good. Especially because he's now in this larger overseeing role in the minor leagues.
Oh, is he, like, minor league pitching coordinator now or something like that?
Yeah, but he was
triple. What was he doing before?
I think he was a triple-A pitching coach last year. But he's been in the system for a while.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's especially when there's something, you know, like pitching development generally where there are so many variables, it's very easy for us to shorthand it and just say like, oh, well, Don Cooper. But and obviously Don Cooper is sort of doing a top-down thing with the development whole process there for pitching, but you know, it's easy to lose sight of other positive factors that are happening there.
Yeah, Han kind of spoke about, some fan was asking him like, how do the pitchers still get Coop's magic, like, if they're not in the majors? And he's like, you know, there's other developmental staff in the organization.
But they don't just show up at like empty ballparks. Like,
it's an underrated skill of general managers to be able to interact with fans without having their eyes fall out of their heads, rolling them too much.
He had some fun. Yep.
The prospects show up at like, there's just a bag of balls and gloves with a note with a phone number where Don Cooper can be reached, and that's it.
Like, call to get pitch signs for every pitch.
Don't eat all the popsicles in the fridge.
His last three starts of the year, he threw 15 innings, struck out 14, allowed 9 hits, 1 run. So pretty good.
Did anyone get roasted for asking a particularly dumb question?
I think the really dumb ones, they like switched into nice mode. There were a couple of like... like, I don't know, two on the nose questions. Like, someone asked Han if he was interested in the post like 2018 free agency class. Like, you know, Josh Donaldson and all that, and Bryce Harper will be available. Is that something you're looking into? And he's just like, maybe.
Like, I don't know what else you're supposed to say. Like, who? You know, what are you?
So how many multiples of the biggest contract the White Sox have ever given out will Bryce Harper sign for? Like,
six?
Four?
At least three. Probably five. Four. Someone else asks Nick Hotstetler, have you been keeping track of Seth Beer? Or are you aware of Seth Beer? And he's like, never heard of him.
It's clearly somebody trying to, like, I'd say show off, but that's not the right phrase. No, but I mean, is Abreu's the highest at 68, right?
Yeah. Yep. He got about that.
The accounting on him is weird because of how you want to count ARB.
It's subject to change.
But there's no way Harper get. Well, I guess what does Harper get if he has like another 850 OPS year for like the next 2 years? Does he still get the, like, $400 million or whatever?
Maybe it's to settle for $200.
I mean, you'd figure he'd get a tick or two. I mean, he'd get noticeably more, but not, like, an order of magnitude more than Hayward, right?
You'd think so.
So that would put him at $250, right? Something?
Yeah, so you're already at – that's already, like, the low end, and that's already, like, almost four times the White Sox record, so –
So he got asked about that, like, will they spend at the end of the contention cycle? He basically just said yes. He said there's no magic number for, you know, maximum contract that they won't exceed. That he claimed ignorance, that he didn't even realize that Abreu was the biggest deal in all time. But he said that's obviously the final step of contention would be that they'd spend at... when they're ready to fill holes on the roster. And he said that he has, that, you know, he's talked to Ryan Zorf and they're on board and they understand what has to be done. The White Sox are obviously in, you know, believe it when you see it territory as far as that, but he at least said the right things.
Yeah, I understand that his hands are tied with what he can say and to, you know, what he can do. But it is a little odd to say, well, obviously that's the last step, because the obvious retort to that is, you know, you were here the last few years. Like, what was it not obvious then? Like, so clearly
Dexter Fowler, like, what?
I mean, yeah, we've never heard them say we couldn't afford him, and we haven't heard them say we missed on our evaluation and we thought he wasn't as, you know, for whatever reason, we didn't think he was as good as he had been or whatever it is. Or they could have even said, like, man, we hated his defense because of the metrics, and I guess we were wrong. Like, we've never gotten any answer on that. And I guess it's hard to comment on players who aren't on your team to that degree, but it's...
Yeah, he didn't go beyond, I mean, they knew that it would take more money to fix it, and they decided not to do that. Like, someone said, like, is it because you weren't able or you weren't willing? And he was just like, yes.
Well, that was certainly, yeah, I mean, the that would have been my conclusion from the outside.
I will say, whenever you talk to Han, he comes off as somebody who knows and understands all the things that we would appeal to and argue about here, and is cognizant of them and kind of says the right things to acknowledge them. Han in person doesn't sound like somebody that BP Southside would disagree with very often. It's the record that we usually have a take issue with.
Yeah, right. Well, it makes me wonder what I'm missing, because, I mean, obviously, you know, I don't work for a team. Clearly Han knows more than I do. But that's why I get confused, where I'm saying, like, geez, well, you know, options A and B would be cheaper and better than what they did do. So what's the disconnect here?
I don't know. Like, if I were Rick Han, I probably would at some point have a tirade where I'm like, well, if we're not going to spend and win with this group, we should just tear it all the way down.
And maybe he did that.
Maybe he did. And now that's what he has.
And you know, and maybe it was just a matter of, like, you know, he was trying it the way ownership wanted him to try it, and once it became abundantly clear it wouldn't work that way, he had more latitude to do things the way he preferred to, which is a theory that I've seen floated in various forms for a while. But it is also weird to hear you talking about it's. I'm still sort of baffled by the 2016 decision making, where you were talking about, well, Shields is a product of desperation, and where they were just scrolling through as many options as they could to try to, you know, patch a hole. When they were, and I've written about this, when they were so passive on the offensive side of the ball, which was also, like, clearly a problem, where, like, for months they just sat there with, like, Jerry Sands and Avisel Garcia as their only DHs. And I'm like, well, this is weird. Like, you could be trying guys from waivers and trades here too. You know, it doesn't just have to be wait till Justin Morneau shows up at, like, you know, the end of July.
When they're already out of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's odd. Like, it's odd that they felt that urgency and that they were willing to devote, you know, Shields wasn't exactly like a cheap contract to take on.
I mean, it'd be one thing to say, like, well, they were kind of a thin contender, and then their first move to kind of, like, patch themselves up for a run was a landmine, but they really couldn't know the depth to which that was a failure, or which that was a disaster. They wouldn't know that soon enough to where, like, it wasn't really till a month or a month and a half where you're like, well, Shields is clearly just, like, not recovering from this at all. Because, like, the second Shields month was not awful. That point, like, the fact that they hadn't done anything more, they'd already kind of made their own beds to that degree.
But even if Shields had pitched basically to what he had done in his, you know, decline phase Shields, where he was still effective, but, you know, not really not the, like, number two starter he'd been for a while, they still would have needed offense, you know, like, regardless. Right.
They should have, they never had a reason to stop and wait to see how that would work.
Like, when Sands was sitting there with, like, a 40 something K percentage in the majors, and he was one of three position players on your bench. So it's just sort of like, you know, there's dudes out there, and I've written about them, and it's like, that's never been clear to me, because that means either they thought Sands or Abisail would be good enough, or they had just given up. But then if you've given up, why are you adding Shields for, you know, like a future commitment of significant dollars? Like none of this is consistent. None of this is internally consistent itself.
They were in a really weird position of being a team that both had, like, at one point, like, at least a 6-game lead, and also probably at least 3 obvious festering sores that need to be immediately addressed.
Right, but they only tried to address one.
Right.
Definitely. I don't know. Do we count 4 and 5 starters as 2 issues?
Well, once Miguel Gonzalez came in, it wasn't really...
Yeah, it took quite a while for it to be clear that he was. I think he wasn't settled into the rotation until Latos is already gone, I thought.
Right, but Latos had been effective until that point.
Yeah, Miguel looked iffy until July. That was his big kick-ass month, and he was pretty stable after that. But it was clear even at their peak that this is a team that'll probably need 3 new adds to their lineup. Or, you know, their general starting core.
I just never understood why they didn't try to upgrade Jerry Sands.
I mean,
did you see Han tomorrow?
No. But that was a way too slow moving adjustment.
And their only internal option fell over and collapsed, right? So, / broke his foot.
Right. It's true.
Who is that?
Matt Davidson.
Oh, right, that. I guess never really considered.
Well, could conceivably have contributed to DH, but didn't.
I mean, I'm low on Davidson. I don't think he would have held up. And the fact that they didn't even mention Davidson all weekend in any of their public appearances didn't really bolster the idea that they think of him as anything more than a flyer.
Right, but I'm just saying in the context of 2016, playing Davidson had much higher upside than playing Jerry Sands.
Yeah, probably.
I didn't mean to drag us back through all these issues that I've been beating my head against the wall about for the last year, but it was interesting to hear you talk about that. Him explicating his thought process like that to say, again, it's like, okay, here's this very lucid line of thinking and problem solving that was being applied on one side of the ball. And then on the other side of the ball, you're just kind of throwing your hands up and just being like, well, geez, this is bad. And that's the extent of it.
Yeah.
But it does sound like, you know, it's the fact that Han is willing to speak this candidly about 2017, we're not expecting to be a playoff team. We are still planning on selling more of these players. His cards are on the table and they're definitely committed to this direction. And hopefully if they're on more stable ground, they'll feel more comfortable investing in it when it, when the next upswing comes.
I mean, he's definitely in this team probably isn't competitive. They're going to do their best, but I'm not going to lie to you. Everyone actually involved in the field is oh, you'll never know. But I mean, theoretically, 2017 team being good at all, because I don't know, the fact that the Indians would, if they randomly collapsed, there's no one else to any good in the division.
I look forward to to Cleveland in 2017 repeating with 79 wins.
It would really kind of screw him up strategically, because then he would have an obviously flawed team that he would probably need to upgrade, and then he'd have to pull from all these trade returns that he just made. It would be a nightmare for him. To go shop Yoan Moncada again for the next Casey Blake.
Do the like 2004 Expos trade, which if they'd kept Cologne, they might have won, given that he's still going. He hasn't quite outlasted Phillips. I'm really hoping he outlasts Phillips, because then he'll have outlasted all three of them. But
all right. He was such a different pitcher then, too. But sorry, James, what were you going
to
say?
I was going to wrap things up, so go for it.
No, that's fine with me. I gotta hit the hay.
Predictions for the ceviche cook-off?
Dysentery.
It's Renteria versus like a professional chef.
Dysentery.
Who's the judge?
Saladino.
Jerry Sands is going to win.
Always believed in them. He's got a chance.
Not striking this time.
They only got two guys. It's not really a cook-off with just two, even irrespective of all the other issues calling it a cook-off.
Both of them are just going to take really well-made ceviche and then put it on a burner until somebody pleads for them to stop. It'll be a cook-off.
Well, it's, on that note, it's been a pleasure, gentlemen.
All right.
Night, guys.
Night.